Well, hello again to everyone out in Turdville. Today is the 10th of October. It's a Thursday, which must mean it's time for another Access to Access webinar. We have a real treat this week. The timing couldn't be better, as we've got the one and only David Morgan on the line to answer your questions. David is just a world-renowned expert in silver. And with everything going on in the world and then just the very challenging market conditions we have to deal with, it seems like on a daily basis, I think there's no better time to have David on than now. David, of course, is the publisher of the subscription Morgan Report, which I would strongly encourage every silver investor, trader, stacker to check out and consider subscribing. He can also be found at his website, silverinvestor.com. That's not just one word, it's silver-investor.com. David, welcome into Turdville.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
Hey, before we get started, and I just as we've done in the past, I want to encourage everybody that's listening to utilize the question section of your toolbar to type in questions directly to David or directly to me, and then I can read them off to David. Before we get started here, I want to ask you about something that I've been noticing all year long, and just get your thoughts on it. I guess it's kind of a two-pronged question. One, we've seen massive outflows from the GLD. It is now down over a third in inventory since the first of the year. It's pushing 34%. So where there used to be three London bars allegedly in its inventory, there are now two. At the same time, we've seen really no change in the inventory of the SLV. So one, if you have any thoughts on that, and then two, the consistent 700,000 to 800,000 a week production numbers coming out of the U.S. Mint of Silver Eagles. It almost seemed to slow a little bit this week for the first time in about 6 months, but it has been a consistent number. Just any insights you might have on that as to where that demand is coming from, you know, just overall thoughts. So anyway, two-pronged question about the SLV versus the GLD, and then what do you think of Silver Eagle demand?
Okay, well, on the gold side, I've always thought that there would probably be the physical squeeze would probably happen on the silver side, not on the gold side. And the reason for that is the physical investment grade silver supply is actually less than the investment grade gold supply. But gold is much more popular than silver is. So it certainly appears that the gold squeeze, physical squeeze, is happening on the gold side. So specific of the GLD, that's a derivative product that's backed by physical, as you well know. And since so much has come off, as you said, about 33%, what that indicates is somebody's demanding physical and are not accepting paper. And then, of course, as I keep, pounding the table, this thing with Germany saying they want their gold back, and the New York Fed says, sure, no problem, give us 7 years. So obviously, there's a disconnect in the gold market between the physical reality and the paper pushes. And this is starting to manifest more and more, the GLD being an example. Now, on the silver side, you ask a great question, one that I've thought about. Doesn't make me right. This is a conjecture on my part. In fact, this is asked by, I won't say who, but a very well-known, one of the best-known in the silver world, and asked me the same question. My take, again, speculation, is that with silver, it is bulkier than gold. I mean, it's certainly very high unit value. I mean, I defy anyone to pick up a cell phone and that much silver, because that much silver, even at today's price, is probably $800. So there's not many things that are the size of a cell phone that alone are worth $800. So it's very high value per volume. But relative to gold, it's very bulky because it's 60 times, and actually more than that because gold's denser than silver, but roughly 60 times more bulky because of the gold-silver ratio. It takes 60 ounces of silver to buy an ounce of gold. So the point I'm making is, if you are a fund manager and you believe in silver a great deal and you get a redemption, what do you do? Well, you might be totally physically oriented, yet what you do is you sell that physical back into the market to send a check or a wire transfer to that redemption. And I think that's part of the problem. that because the physical reality of silver is, you know, takes 60 times actually more than that, the space of gold, even if you're in the physical realm only. But that doesn't discount the next part of the question, which is your stackers. And these are the, you know, I'll call them the awake and aware individuals out there worldwide that just keep buying, you know, 10 ounces a month or 1 ounce a month or 100 ounces a month or 50 ounces a month, and they just keep stacking away. And that puts a squeeze on the physical supply. So I really, sorry about that.
That's all right.
Phone just went off. So I think that it's a two-prong situation. I think gold is showing the physical demand stronger than silver currently, but since silver is a smaller market, it could catch up very quickly. In either case, what boggles my mind, and I don't have an answer for anyone, but I'll voice it, is the amount of silver that has gone into the COMEX over the last year and a half or so. It's mostly in the eligible category, which means it's being stored on the COMEX in safekeeping. It cannot be sold unless another piece of paper is signed. In other words, if I'm storing my silver at the COMEX, which is really a bank and a vault, and I decide I want to sell some of my physical, what I have to do from the eligible category is I've got to sign a document and send it to my broker saying I really want to sell this and put it into the registered category. The registered category really hasn't increased much at all, but the amount being stored. And what boggles my mind about that is why would you? After the MF Global debacle, and then they moved their people to PFG and it had problems, why would you trust them to store your silver? And I can't answer that question.
It certainly would seem illogical to do that. You're absolutely right. How do you feel about this consistent demand for silver eagles from the mint? Is it, I mean, it was to the point where they only update now once a week. It was always almost every single week about 800,000 that they would show. So it was about 3.2 million a month, depending on, or 4 million a month, depending on how many Mondays there were in a month. What do you make of that? Is that, some folks have speculated that shows heavy foreign buying. I spoke with Andy Hoffman at Miles Franklin a couple of weeks ago, and he said, you know, our retail silver demand hasn't really been very strong ever since about the middle of the summer. I don't, do you have any thoughts on why the silver eagle demand is so high?
Well, a couple of things. One is, I'll agree with Andy, it is the most popular coin in the world. And there is a subset of the silver stackers that do not want or trust, let's say, privately minted coins that you might get from the Sunshine Mint, for example. So they want a government-stamped coin, which, of course, the silver eagle, again, is the most popular of that, and, of course, the Canadian maple. And there are other government-issued silver ounces, but that's the most popular. So that's part of the equation. I think it's also a subtle clue that regardless of what you hear in the mainstream press, the physical demand for silver goes on unabated. Now, it's hard to make a conjecture from such a microcosm of the silver market, silver eagles, and you know, extrapolate that out into the rest of the coin world, the bag market, and more specifically in the bullion market. Because we haven't seen any big players such as Eric Sprott or Stefan Spicer or the Zurich Continental Bank or any of the big players that have large physical holdings that we know and can trust take a large purchase of silver here in the last several months. And so that would really tell the tale. In other words, for example, if the Central Fund of Canada decided to make a new issue and decided to buy, just make up a number, 20 million ounces of silver, and there was a delay or stalling or whatever, that would give us a big clue that things aren't right with the silver market. On the other hand, if it just poured in within, you know, a few days, that would indicate, obviously, that, you know, the bullion market is not that tight. But we don't know because no one has really done that here in the last several months, as I just said. So all we can really go by is what are the little guys doing? And they're continuing to buy. So I think it's a healthy sign. Anyone that follows my work and several that don't, because I do so many of these public type of interviews and some private like this one, Turd, and again, thank you for inviting me. We did a very deliberate study on what the true cost of silver is for a silver producer, and we're not taking any, you know, small companies. We're taking like the First Majestic, which is now on the New York Stock Exchange, as you well know. And basically, it varies company to company and mine to mine, and within First Majestic, they have more than one mining operation. But generally speaking, you can use a rule of thumb of about $22 an ounce.
Wow.
So that means anyone that's below that is a very marginal producer, and even the ones that are at that are not really making much money, if any money, at this price. So I think that's pretty much a floor. It doesn't mean it can't trade below that. It can, but it can't trade below that number for an extended period of time. So coming back to the stackers, I think they're being very smart, because they're basically buying silver that's in one of the best forms, Silver Eagles we're talking about, that's the best recognized coin in the world, and they're purchasing it without the encumbrance of mining it, smelting it, refining it, minting it, and everything else. I joked when Warren Buffett bought 129.7 million ounces of fine silver that he was the best silver miner in the world, because he bought silver way under the cost of production,
yeah.
And all he had was a slight storage problem, nothing else, no EPA studies, no, government interference, none of that stuff. He just basically took, 20% of the world's silver supply at the time and stuck it in the vault somewhere. I mean, that's a great silver miner.
Do you, one last question, I guess, on the miners. It brings up this question that I get all the time about, do you continue to hold miners even if you're underwater? I don't want to try to put you on the spot for investment advice. That's not the intent of the question, but, with so many of them that are now struggling and with prices at this level, is it for those that are in the miners, do you wait until after a stock market crash and then maybe see if you can double down or wait till prices bottom out and see what companies are left? Do you have a strategy for the miners? You just buy a big basket like we used to with .com companies and just hope that a handful of them make it, like you're a venture capitalist? Do you have a strategy, David?
Well, I do. It's been pretty consistent all along. I mean, basically what we do is we have three categories, a top tier, a mid tier, and a speculative category. In the speculative category, it's basically bet what you can afford to lose. The biggest mistake a lot of resource investors make, and I made it myself when I was much, much, much younger, and that is to bet too much on an up-and-coming company. And not spreading out enough. So speculation is just that. Now, I've had speculations where they've turned into great big wins. Haven't had one lately. It's been a pretty tough market, as you know.
Yeah.
But, for example, Western Copper. Well, Western Copper turned into Western Silver, and it was bought out by, I forget who, one company, and that was bought out by Goldcorp. So it changed hands. That was a huge, huge win. And it was started as a speculation, but as the story got better and more confirmation was made, even though the price was higher, it became a more conservative investment because we had much more information and data about the company. So that's one way. On the top tier, I've said if you buy in to the top tiers, and all of these you got to spread out. I mean, you've got to have like at least five different companies, because something can go wrong. Mm-hmm. In the mining business. So you don't want just one. But conservative investors can stay in that part of the portfolio. These are companies that are, billion-dollar market caps or higher. You can write options on your positions. You can protect yourself pretty easy. They're very liquid. If you made a mistake, you can get out with a mouse click very easily. The mid-tiers is where we've been focusing since about 2010. And our favorite model there is like a First Majestic, which is pretty much, I think, still have some upside potential, but go back a few years. I mean, we had it at $4 a share well before it was on the New York Stock Exchange, and it traded under that for quite some time, but I knew we had a winner, and the market eventually recognized that. But it's a company that has exploration potential, that's producing at a profit and has upside because of exploration potential. That's the safest way to go. So we focus most of our efforts on that classification. So that's the overall strategy. Now, getting to your specific questions, do you double down after a stock market crash, or do you wait for the market to come up, and what do you do? These are subsets of how to trade or how to invest or how to work within this market. My take, for right or wrong, has been it's really too late to see the crash in the mining shares. My view is even if we had a stock market crash, there's no sellers left in the mining sector. So would they go down? Yes, probably they would, especially the bigger names like a Pan American Silvers or that type of thing. But it would be so temporary because, again, there are no sellers left. This thing is washed out. The last seller has sold pretty much. So what that would mean is that would be the final oomph, and it wouldn't take these shares much lower, I don't think. I really believe this. So now is probably a good time to accumulate, not necessarily bet the farm on them, but certainly start building your positions. Because even if, again, the stock market crashed, I don't think the miners could get down. We're at a situation where we're like a two or three sigma. I mean, we're at the very end. Anyone knows what a bell curve looks like? The tail risk, if you remember, at the end of either the left side or the right side of the curve. Those are very, very remote possibilities. And that's where we are in the mining shares right now. This is the first time in about two or three decades where you've had a ratio between the XAU and the gold price at this extreme, meaning that you can buy so much gold in the ground per dollar invested versus what you can get in physical gold. So I think the opportunity is there, but I don't want to, jump up and down and say, if you don't do it by the end of today, you're making a mistake. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is if you don't understand the market and take participation in this, I think you are, you should question that. Now, let me take a breath and go on slightly. I've been very consistent. You should have real metal first, above all. And the reason for that is you're outside the matrix. If you're ever in a collapse scenario or a halted situation where the stock market's halted for whatever reason, or there's a bank holiday, or any of these very, again, at the end of the tail situations that have a very low probability, but nonetheless they do exist, the best thing to have is a physical metal. Once you've accomplished what you need for your physical portfolio and you want to go into the next higher risk to reward profile, then you want to look at the miners and you want to go from top tier to mid tier to speculations. Again, most people and a lot of my colleagues just spend all their time in the speculative section. And I won't name names, but a couple of these guys are almost out of business because they had nothing but these junior exploration companies. That The time to be in the junior exploration companies was 2000 to 2005 or 6, somewhere in there. A lot of these things moved just on their names. They didn't really have any merit. Since about that time frame, you really wanted to be in producing companies or near producers. And from here on out, you want to be in producers unless you have some, I would call it inside information, but you are so solid on what this junior that you have has asset-wise and it has enough capital in the treasury to keep going for a couple of years if things remain, sideways that long, which I doubt. But so you want to be very, very careful if you're in the speculative category, is what I'm saying.
I think that's words of wisdom spoken like a guy that's been around for a while. You've seen good times and bad, no doubt about that. David, I want to head into some of the member questions, and I'm just going to take them as they've come in and read it off to you. And I can tell already they're going to be varied in terms of what folks are asking. This first one's going to is actually has to do with the bond market. Comes from a regular at our site who goes by the name of Pining for the Fjords. And Pining wants to know, I guess he saw an interview that you did with Greg Hunter maybe a week, 10 days ago. And in that interview, he says that you said you were not that worried about hyperinflation because the bond market is a self-regulating entity. Since as interest rates are forced higher, bond prices are forced down, and this is deflationary. So no hyperinflation. Pining's question is, we know that the Fed is now taking down as much as 80% of all new treasury issuance, and thus through quantitative easing, controlling yield and price. So knowing that, why would you still expect a normal self-correcting forces of supply and demand to apply? And then he goes on to say, doesn't this mean that the new normal market check of higher yields creating a balancing deflationary headwind is now absent?
Possibly. Let me be clear, though, beyond that question, and I'll try to answer it. What I do believe is that you do not need a hyperinflation to cause a currency crisis. In other words, there's no set point where you have a shunning of the currency where you just don't want the dollar. And that's already taking place. And I'm sure this guy's very
Right.
sophisticated or woman, whoever's asking this. So what you have is shunning of the dollar. Well, who shunned the dollar? Well, China, Russia, India, Brazil, the BRICS, for the most part, have gone circumvented the dollar. So will the mechanism of interest rates cause bond prices to go opposite? Yeah, I don't think you can get around that. But what my point is that you don't have to get to, 25% or 100% inflation. And my point is that you're not going to get these huge inflation rates. But regardless, you're going to have a currency crisis. You're going to say, I don't want the dollar anymore. Well, as he points out, 80% is bought by the Fed. If you look at John Williams, who I get and have a subscription to and still do for years, from his latest one that I read, I think I'm two behind, he said 100% since this year has been bought by the Fed. So we're monetizing our own situation. The world gets this. I mean, China's already sent a little strong message saying, hey, you guys get your act together and you better raise the debt limit because we hold all this debt. So the self-regulating thing I want to put too much emphasis on, what I want to emphasize is that if you're in Zimbabwe and you have no bond market, you can keep printing up, and that's why you can get to these trillion-dollar bills. Right. In an advanced economic system like we have, where we're still the reserve currency of the world and there is a bond market, if interest rates do go up and you got to sell your bond portfolio, you're going to get less cash for it. But that's not the big point. That's part of the idea. The idea, again, is that you need to understand that you don't have to look for official inflation rates or even John Williams inflation rates for the currency crisis to happen. That's the point.
Right.
Japan is the worst case out there. It's the second biggest debtor nation, yet it has a much smaller population than the U.S., and they are on this absolutely absurd goal of 2% inflation and doubling the money supply in 2 years. I mean, that's hyperinflationary, but yet, you know, the market could put pressure on their interest rates regardless. This is insanity. So as far as I'm concerned, the obvious is staring us at the face. If you're, you know, sophisticated like this person asking the question, it's looking right at us. People and nation states particularly are getting out of the dollar. China's very smart. I think most of our trading partners are, that they don't want to exit too quickly because that could cause a panic or a crash, and no one wants that. They just want to be, you know, it's like selling a stock at the top. If you're a fund manager and you have a lot of stock, what do? You do what's called distribution. You sell some every day for the next, whatever, month and a half until you're out of your position. If you sold your whole position at once, you take the market down hard. So when you have these big positions, you've got to filter out of them. You got to get in slowly and out slowly because you have so much of it, you will move the market. So hopefully I answered this question. I am not here, you know, I'm just doing the best I can. I certainly understand the bond market, but there's a lot to it, and there could be something I miss. I've never taken a position that I'm a know-it-all, but certainly with the degree in finance / economics and looking at this for years, and I'm still learning more, that's my take.
No, you did answer the question, and I appreciate that. And it, for everybody listening, I know going through everybody's mind is only if you are interested in not getting an efficient execution and influencing price as much as you can, would anyone ever even consider dumping an entire position at once, which we saw just this morning again.
Yeah, let me interject there for a second because it's very pertinent what you just said. This is exactly what takes place in the silver and gold market.
Exactly.
And I won't say all the time, but why would anyone dump 2/3 of the annual silver supply in, you know, a few trades?
Right.
No one would do that. There's only one reason, and that's to drive the price down.
Right.
And so it's obvious that it's a manipulation, but yet, you know, our authority figures look the other way or have some excuse or there's not enough information or whatever. Anyway,
that's
let me
right.
go on, but I just had to get that little rant in there.
You're right here, you're home preaching that stuff. Believe me, we're all right with you. All right, moving on. Again, anybody that's listening, I'm reading these questions right out of the, the dialogue box in your GoToWebinar control panel where you can type in questions. But I probably should move on because we've been at this for a little over 20 minutes and obviously we can't keep you all day. This one comes from Kelly, who wants to know, in the case of a fiat collapse, what will be the perceived differences in quality and tradability? And I think Kelly's talking about coins here. What will be the easiest to trade besides pre-1965 coins?
Good question. Speculation on my part. One, it would depend where you are. So let's think globally instead of the U.S. I'll answer U.S.-centric only. Basically, I think that she or he, Kelly, could be either a man or a woman.
Right.
But regardless, Kelly, the answer is that you're right. Pre-64 and earlier coins, you could show a six-year-old kid and teach him that that's real silver probably within a few minutes.
Yeah.
So I think that's the most exchangeable. Beyond that, I think the silver eagle is probably the best because that's pretty recognizable as well and, again, can be taught within a few minutes. Outside of that, it depends where you are. I studied the 2000 collapse of Argentina and read some, regular folks kind of stuff that reported on it. And what was interesting was learning what I learned. And that is that jewelry turned out to be, he said that he wished he had more jewelry, more, gold rings and gold necklaces and silver rings and silver earrings and silver bracelets and that kind of thing. Because down on the street, when you're looking for, silver for apples kind of thing, it was actually jewelry that seemed to do as well as coins itself. So, again, that's a global perspective, not a U.S.-centric perspective. But it's something I really hadn't thought of that much until I read this very massive series of articles that this particular group had written about what actually took place during the collapse in Argentina. And that's in 2000. That wasn't that long ago.
Is
so
that...
I would say silver eagles, maybe, but silver is silver. But it's hard to prove. I mean, in a collapse scenario or a barter situation, if you have a privately minted coin, people are going to say, how do I know that's real silver?
Right.
There's ways to find out too. But nonetheless, if it's just, silver, junk silver, or I like to call it constitutional silver, and silver eagles would probably be the best in the U.S. Outside of the U.S., it would vary.
And it gets back mainly to in a fiat collapse, we're talking about a lack of trust in general, across the board and everything. And so it gets back to it. I would imagine what you're saying is kind of a trust and verifiability type of thing where people, if you're looking to barter, people are going to look at a U.S. issued coin pre-1965 or eagle or jewelry. Cause they're going to see a silver ring or a silver necklace or gold and say, okay, well, this is a much higher likelihood of being actual metal than it is, just this round that you have from somewhere. So it's kind of a trust.
And people are smart. I mean, it doesn't take too long. In fact, in the bazaar, or in the open market, the farmer's market, if you will, I mean, there could be a booth set up where this person's whole deal is some acid and a scale and a way to measure volume and say, no, it's got to be. And on the jewelry, if it's stamped, doesn't make it necessarily that it's really what it's stamped, but there's a good chance that it is. And there's ways, and people are smart, and when things get tough, believe me, their consciousness goes up an order of magnitude or so. When you're out there on the street and you're in more of a survival mode, you catch on pretty quick. So
yeah.
There's a lot that goes on beyond it. The market will work it out. You'll learn pretty quick. If you get in that situation, believe me, within probably a month's time, the market would tell you what's preferred, if you got to give a discount for a silver round, and that type of thing. So just have faith that, people are pretty awesome and they'll work together. I mean, anyway, I don't want to go too far down that rabbit hole, but you would find out pretty quickly that it's not that cumbersome, believe me.
All right, moving on to a question from Ben. And this gets to something I was going to ask. Towards the end, if it didn't come up, lots of talk is being made of the import duties of gold in India and the kind of fallacy of that and the black market and the demand is there regardless. But then a lot of folks are wondering if Indian demand for silver will increase as an alternative. And that's kind of Ben's question here. He says there are lots of articles that India is now importing lots of silver, possibly 25% of 2013 annual mine production, as well as Japan and China's push into solar production. But we haven't really seen that impact silver prices yet. Why do you think that is?
Well, I'd say the why is, the paper pushers, the derivative markets certainly influence the price. So I think that's the answer there. I hate to be curt, but that's about the best you can state it.
Sure.
As far as silver, I kind of laugh only because of my age. But India, as much as they love gold and as much has gone into India in the last, I don't know, several years, silver was what they bought for years and years and years. In fact, when the Hunt Brothers scenario took place, there was an article, I think it was either in Barron's or the Wall Street Journal, it's one of the top, and it was called Hunts versus a Billion Indians, and they meant Indians from India.
Right.
Because they saved in silver, and most of them saved in jewelry form. And that had been the case for eons, I mean, for a long, long, long time. But as they became wealthier, because of, you know, the telephone answering service thing and everything else that's gone on, and that's what comes to mind, they were able to afford gold. So they started moving to the gold market. But they've always been savers of silver. And now with this situation where they've, you know, taxed the import of gold, they've gone back to silver probably more. Will it have an impact? Yes. Has it moved the price yet? No, as he said. But it could, and eventually these managed markets don't last forever. I mean, people probably are tired of me saying that, or Ted Butler saying that, or Ed Steer, or Eric Sprott, or Bill Murphy, or anybody. But the truth is, they don't last forever. And especially as we started this whole webinar, especially on the gold side. I mean, gold seems to be having more pressure physically. And the thing on the gold I didn't mention, which everyone on this call probably knows, is the central banks have become net buyers the last few years. So you've got nation states that are buying, especially in the East, Russia, China, India. You have central bank buying, and the only way to kind of quell the market and keep a lid on it is to keep selling these derivative products. But, you know, paper doesn't equal physical, and it's putting pressure on it. And when will it take off, or how will it take off? No one can really state. But again, coming back to Germany, something is really wrong. If there's all this gold out there and they can't deliver it to the rightful owner, it's going to take 7 years. Come on.
Yeah. All right. Here's a question about a specific miner, I guess, mining equity. I don't know. I'm glad you're here because I don't know about this one. But Keg wants to know if you have any insight into what he called the beatdown of PVG yesterday.
I put out an update for our members only, and I can't really give specific stock advice. I'm probably legal to do this because it's not an individual. I'm not allowed to give individual investment advice. I would go to Seeking Alpha and type in PVG. Basically, there was the outfit that does the analysis on the grade was the same outfit that did the analysis on BREX. And anyone that's as old as me, or you're not as old as me, can look it up on the web. But BREX was basically a fraud. And there were these very high grades coming out of BREX. And so this company is probably hair-triggered to the conservative position. My guess, and this is only a guess, is that the grades were pretty high on this. But it was, I think, I forget the amount, 10 tons, I think it was. You look it up. And they probably came back to the company and said, we want to do a different sample or a bigger sample or something like that. So it could be something along those lines. I don't speculate too much, but it probably revolved around the grade and verification of the grade. And a word used in the press release was methodology. I think, you know, a simple PVG search of the news in Google, read the latest three articles, you'll probably have a very good take on it. My alignment on it, being me, is to be neutral. For the record, I own it. For the record, I think a lot of Bob Quartermain. For the record, it's not a sell on the Morgan Report. It's a hold right now. Looks to me as if the market probably overreacted, but I want to stay pretty much neutral and see, you know, what kind of shakes out in the next month or two. That's it. So
fabulous.
Count that all as opinion only and speculation on my part. But as far as who the management is, where the property is, what the grades are, I think that nothing, no funny business has gone on. I just think that this outfit that was responsible for the assay is a little bit concerned for whatever reason. And I really don't know what I said is speculation on my part.
Well, I think it's a fabulous answer. I think that's a wonderful answer, and I very much appreciate it, because if the question had been posed to me, my answer would have been, huh?
Okay.
So thank you for any insight that you can share. I want to, again, invite anybody. We've got a few minutes left. If you have a question, just type it into that dialogue box that you see in your control panel. I see Keg appreciated that information as well. He put in a quick thank you. And I want to invite the question I have remaining from Carl. Carl, I want to take that one offline. So if you would email me at tfmetalsreport@gmail.com, and I will answer the question that you have. Anybody else that wants to put in a question in our remaining minutes, please use that. In the meantime, while we're just see if there's any other questions out there, I want to ask if you could address this for everybody again, David, because you answered this better than anybody else I've ever seen answer. When we did a podcast, God, whenever it was, 12 months ago, you said, because you know, there's always all this talk out there, people saying, well, why doesn't somebody just go to the COMEX and take 10,000 contracts and deliver and break the damn thing and let's get it over with? And that just kind of came up in conversation. And you said, look, what people understand, have you ever actually taken the time to read the paperwork from the CME, from the COMEX? And you said, you know, within that, you recognize that no single entity can deliver more than 1,500 contracts. This continues to come up, obviously, especially with the decline in COMEX gold inventories this year. Can you just spell that out in English again for everybody, so everybody that's listening can understand what's, I guess, the barriers that are in place that are put there by the COMEX to protect itself?
Yeah, very good. Well, you did a good surmise of it.
Oh, okay. Well, forget it then.
The idea is, as you stated, that you know people think that, well, why doesn't a rich person or a big hedge fund or a nation state come in and buy up all the silver, all the gold, or both, and get it over with? And the answer is, again, read the contract. The contract, specifically in silver, is you cannot take more than 1,500 contracts off the COMEX, which is 7.5 million ounces. So that is the deal. Now, I actually asked that question years ago. There was a silver gathering, I'll call it, here in Spokane, headed by Phil Baker, who had just at that time become the CEO of Hecla Mining. So you have to go back in the records. I forget what year it was. But it was quite a little parade of the top echelon in the silver market. Excuse, I hope I didn't sound egotistical on that. But it was some of the bigger miners. It was a Silver Users Association. It was the CME, it was the Silver Institute. It was many, many, mostly on the mainstream side. In other words, like the Silver Institute, Silver Users, I wouldn't call mainstream, but that type of thing. So it had a lot to do with almost all aspects of the silver market. They also had, I forget the name of the entity, but they're responsible for the oversight of manufacturing and production of silver bars, and I forget the name of it, it's IG something, something A. Anyway, all these different, and I'm the only maverick in the crowd. They had the CME there. And he spoke, and he said, first thing he said was the CME did not break the rules, or he used the word COMEX, I think, on Hunt Brothers, that they had only enforced the rules that already existed. And I wanted to go back and put his feet to the fire, but obviously I couldn't do it in the audience, and smartphones didn't even exist back then. But I couldn't find that data later. Anyway, getting back on point, he made that statement. So anyway, time goes on, so now it's Q&A, and I asked this guy. I said, well, what if you wanted to take the limit, the 1,500 contracts month after month after month? At what point would the CME say you can't take it anymore? And he gave me pretty much a non-answer. What he said is, well, you wouldn't want to buy it off the exchange. You'd buy it from a major broker-dealer. I said, oh, humor me. I go, I've done it, at a very low scale. I'm not Warren Buffett, but I've done it. I've taken a small contract and taken 1,000-ounce bars off the exchange, and, it's a pretty cheap way to do it. You pay the paper price and you add some fees on top of it and you get it shipped, and it's really a smart way to do it if you're in the mood for 1,000 ounces at a time. And his answer, again, was pretty vague. You wouldn't want to do it. Well, even if you did do it, basically, again, he kind of weaseled out of it, and it's going from my memory, was, look, we're protected. We can do what the rules say, which is we can make you settle in cash. You probably get a phone call. You probably, get nixed on the deal. So having said that, that the rules are what they are. So when you sign a contract to trade futures, better understand what you're signing up for. You're signing up that 97% of the time or greater, if you're settling in cash, regardless. I mean, all this activity is almost always settled in cash, very little. So I look at the LBMA and more so the COMEX as display windows. It's like a big car dealer that's for, you know, any automobile, but probably higher end automobiles. And they might have a couple Jaguars out there and one Rolls or something. And you go in and you look at it and go, man, isn't that cool? I'd love to own one of those. Or maybe you could afford one. But it's a display case. Most of the silver and gold that comes through the market never touches the LBMA, never touches the COMEX. There's this misconception that all this stuff flows through there. No, those are display windows. That's what those are. They are just there to show you what it looks like. Most of it goes directly from the smelter to the user. That's what the Silver Users Association is all about. It's about putting the great big huge conglomerates like BHP and Rio Tinto and some of the bigger miners, the Newmont types, in alignment with the end users, the jewelers in the case of gold, or banks or bullion banks specifically, direct, circumventing. So this idea is, unfortunately, the tail wagging the dog. It's a display case that's controlling the price. It's like, look at this neat shiny stuff. Isn't it wonderful? How much would you pay for this?
Yeah.
Not can you or will you, because most of the time, no, you don't. And because of that, these big entities, such as the BHPs, turn over what's called their book, which is the amount of physical production that they have, to a bullion bank in most cases, and they lever it. 100 to 1, 200 to 1, 500 to 1, 5 to 1, I don't know. I mean, but they lever it. And because the markets work as they work, you can put out, again, a great deal of selling that doesn't exist. I mean, who could produce 2/3 of the annual silver supply in 20 seconds? Nobody. But yet it's allowed to go on exchange. By the way, just for the record, some of these trades are really outside the purview of what the limits are.
Right.
But yet the exchange seems to look the other way. So this idea that we should have position limits is the same thing as like we should have a debt ceiling limit. I mean, the Grand Rudman bill, I forget what year it was passed, was to put a limit on how much debt we could incur.
Yep.
But it's just ignored every year and they up it and up it and up it and up it. It's similar here on the sell side in gold and silver. It's like, well, there is a limit, but it's just ignored. I mean, I've said, you know, you could sell as much that doesn't exist as you want, but try to buy more than 1,500 contracts and see what happens.
Yeah.
It's very, very biased to the short sellers, very biased. One other part, again, is that if you're a commercial category, which basically means a bullion bank and the precious metals, the amount of margin is less, because the exchange considers you to be a producer. Now, bullion banks aren't really producers, but you can make the argument that they're tied into the larger miners or whatever.
Right.
And so they don't have to put up as much margin to hold a position. So isn't that an advantage? And then, of course, a bullion bank has what? Unlimited funds. I mean, they can just, you know, talk to the Fed and get unlimited cash. I mean, I'm being a bit facetious, but I think that you got the right idea. So then, of course, everyone takes a deep breath and goes, I'm getting out of the market. It's obvious they can control it to the end of time. And the answer to that, of course, is they cannot. Just keep stacking. And even, look at the tail end of the curve like we started at the beginning of this webinar. I mean, those things do exist. And the probability, in my view, is getting greater and greater. Look, 2008 did happen. It was roughly 5 years ago. And look what happened to everything, gold included, but gold went down less than almost everything else. It was the first to snap back. Silver snapped back from 9, went all the way to 48. Doesn't mean it will repeat. I think it could. But you wanted to have something that was outside of the counterparty risk department. You wanted to have those metals at that time, even though they did sell off. And most people took advantage of it. I mean, several were scared to death for a while. It was a pretty short-lived case. Point I'm making is simple. We had a financial crisis. It has not gotten better. The leverage in the system has continued to grow, not abate. These bankers don't know what to do. Solving the debt problem by adding to the debt is only making the problem worse. And the day of reckoning, I think, is getting closer by the minute. I mean, I don't know when it'll happen, though, neither does anyone else. But the fundamental facts are stronger now than they were in 2008. The leverage in the system is worse, and the situation is such that a tipping point or trigger point is probably closer than we all think. And again, going back to the fact that a lot of these nation states now have circumvented the dollar as much as they possibly can, at least at this juncture, is a different reality than in 2008 when everyone was tied to the dollar and the idea was, oh my goodness, you know, let's get in that safe haven, let's get into the U.S. buck. Well, that's not the thinking anymore. So there's a lot out there. You know, take a deep breath, think these things through. Don't take my word for anything. Think on your own. Get educated. Do what's right for you. You know, and one more thing, not to sound like too much of a gloomer, but, you know, prioritize your specific needs. Everybody's an individual out there. Think like one and look at what's best for you. Maybe in your case, you know, it might be not saving in silver. Maybe you need a bigger, you know, food supply. I mean, I like bets that you can't lose. I mean, let's say someone that's on a minimal income buying extra food, that's a no-lose bet. I mean, you cannot lose by having extra food in the pantry. Yep. There's nothing that could go wrong with that scenario.
That's absolutely right. And again, I on behalf of everybody, I want to thank you for being so generous with your time, David. I've got to there's a few more questions, but I think I'll just ask you this last one about, I mean, what are you watching in terms of price? I just put out something this morning, hoping for a kind of a big, gigantic reverse head and shoulder bottom that is still trying to form on the silver chart. Do you have any targets, or is there any, I guess, technical or trading numbers that you're watching personally in silver and gold for everybody?
Well, plug myself. I mean, there is a membership portion, which is the upgraded service, which I do all this charting and you get to hear my wonderful voice. I just did one showing the head and shoulders bottom. And I have said in the past that I thought we'd see 26 by the end of the year. One of my members asked me, do I still think that? And the answer is yes, but qualitatively, because, and then I drew the chart, I drew some lines, and I said what the dynamics are and what we would have to see by the end of October, early November, for me to be convinced that we were going to see 26. So, you know, I don't really have time to do that. It's much better done in a chart. I'm not saying this guy should get. Oh, by the way, here's what you can do. If you really want to see what I said about that, go to the website, silver-investor.com, get on the free email list. During the process of the first, I think it's a couple of weeks or so, you'll get the 10 rules of silver investing, which you've probably read on the web anyway. But there is an offer during that process that lets you get the full-blown membership for 30 days for free. So you can go in and you can watch every video I've ever made. You can see the calls that were right, the calls that were wrong. You can verify. I called the top at 48. You can verify a lot of things. And you can go in there and have a look at this video. So that's something for everybody on this call. Is just go to silver-investor.com, get on the free list, and during that first couple of weeks on the free list, there will be a one-time email that says, this is your one chance to get the Morgan Report for free for 30 days. Click here. Do it. You'll get it. We live our word. You can look at everything. And most people are kind of blown away by the amount of work that's on there. Not only is the basic service, which is the monthly report, on there and stacked up for I don't know how far back they go. The advanced service goes back a year. But all these videos that we've done on mining sites, interviews we've done, that type of thing, and all these special reports, not only on mining companies, but, you know, how to trade silver in your sleep, how to, you know, get a pink sheet stock without getting burned, and on and on and on to go. I don't want to do the hard sell too much, but that would be a way for this guy to see what I said. But the basic idea is we're trading in a trading range right now, and I don't like it. I don't like the markets the way they're trading. They're not reacting the way I think they could based on, you know, Janet Yellen. I mean, they called Bernanke, you know, Helicopter Ben. I call her Supersonic Janet.
Yeah.
I mean, I think she's going to have the Concorde come out of mothballs and fly and drop bundles of money. I'm trying to be facetious, obviously. But what I'm saying is she's very dovish. We wrote a great little write-up on her in the last Morgan Report of what her basic philosophy is. And her ideas about inflation are quite opposite of what an Austrian school person would think, which is yours truly. So there's a lot going on. It's very interesting times. But I think to conclude, just, you know, there's more to life than the financial markets. There's more to life than a fiat, problem, which obviously we're in. Take time to prioritize your life and excuse the philosophy, but, get real. I mean, I always say get real, buy real, be real, and I mean that. Be real to kids, your family, the ones you love. Cherish what really is important. A lot of what's important in life is intangible. I mean, there's no measurement for how much love you give out to other people or how much truth you speak or how you carry yourself. These are very valuable things, and they'll be more valuable in the future because as things unwind and the overall living standard of the globe, especially I think the Western Hemisphere, comes down, it behooves us as human beings for what we are as humans to come up. In other words, our spiritual development should probably go commensurate with the decline. In other words, we should be more real, more helpful, more giving, more loving, and that type of thing as things deteriorate. Now, that's my take, like it or leave it. I don't give that message often, but this is a private interview, and some people want to get into my head and my heart, so I just gave it to you. Like it or not, that's what I believe. I think the actual readjustment, you might call it, that's in our not-too-distant future is one to be approached from that aspect rather than, a scarcity mentality of I've got mine and you go get yours. I think it's more about how we can work together than how we can separate.
Agreed. And I would imagine most folks that are listening feel the same way. And I just very much appreciate you sharing that, David. You're absolutely spot on. And really very much appreciate you spending all of this time with us this morning. I'll be posting this so that everybody can listen to it eventually, but it's just has been terrific to get your perspective directly, and I know everybody listening appreciates it. So thank you very much. I want to encourage everybody to go sign up, as David mentioned, for the email newsletter, and then you get that 30-day deal where you can go in and check things out. And I would imagine most of you will then be hooked because it is a fantastic service. So thank you, David, very much for all your time, and hopefully we can do this again soon. Maybe once the calendar flips over, we'll see how things look, and we can kind of do a 2014 preview or something like that.
Well, very good. Well, thanks for having me.
David, thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
Okay.